Sid Wilkes and the robber barons, straight to hell, the greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found, whose crimes have gone unpunished now, walk the streets a screaming now. Okay, this is Alternative Visions. Welcome, all you 1%ers. Oh, not the 1%, the 99%, excuse me. 1% don't listen to this show. Anyway, today we're going to get a little esoteric. We're going to talk about the global bond bubble that is accelerating. Yes, bonds. Not stocks, bonds. The next crisis will be precipitated by problems in global bond markets, both government bonds and corporate bonds. Recently, Bill Gross, maybe some of you don't know who Bill Gross was, he was called the bond guru of the last decade, made some big bets on bonds, made a lot of money recently. Started or moved over to Janus Capital and is a big shot over there. And he just had a statement here yesterday that there is a $10 trillion negative yield, negative bond yield, negative interest rate yield, supernova, as he put it, that will soon explode. Global yields in bonds, in other words, the interest rate, when we say yields, we mean interest rate, on bonds are their lowest in 500 years of recorded history. We have at least $10 trillion global sovereign or government bonds in negative rate territory. And he says this is going to explode one day. In other words, he's not putting an exact date on it, but we are moving closer and closer. Just to give you a sense of how important the bond markets are, far more important than stock markets. Stock markets at the end of 2014 were about worth, the capitalization, the worth about $64 trillion. Global stock markets, the valuations. That, by the way, is up from $32 trillion in 2007 to $64 trillion today. In other words, through this whole crisis that we supposedly had in 2007, 8, 9, and the slow economic growth ever since 2009, stock markets have doubled. The valuations of stocks have doubled. Well, not much of a crisis for them, was it? No. The rest of us are struggling with no wage gains or wage cuts, benefit cuts, converting full-time jobs to part-time contingent jobs. You know, that's a big reason, if I can digress a little bit, why we see the job growth. Companies are eliminating one full-time job, and they're replacing them with two part-time jobs. That doubles the employment, because as far as unemployment is concerned, whether you're working part-time or full-time, it's considered a job creation, a job gain. So how much of all these job gains in the last few years have been companies simply getting rid of full-time and hiring two part-time equivalents? Well, we know a lot of these jobs are low-paid service, part-time, contingent, temp kind of jobs. So how much of this job gain is really not really gains at all? And, you know, that explains why we have, at least in part, why we have no income growth, wage stagnation, median family incomes going down. Well, that's because when you give up a higher-paid full-time job for two lower-paid part-time jobs, you got wage decline in an aggregate sense. Okay, well, I don't want to get off into jobs. We talked about that in some detail last week. If you're interested in my take on the latest U.S. job numbers, go to the PRN website here, the show Alternative Visions, and you can listen to my last show on that topic last week. This week we're talking about the bond market, the global bond market. How significant is it? Well, I just said far more significant than the stock market. Even though the stock markets have doubled from $30 to $64 trillion, bond markets are at least 3-4 times larger than the global stock markets. Bond markets, if the bond markets have a crisis, it will make 2008 pale in comparison. Bonds are far more important than stocks because there's just so much more in the bond market, investments in the bond market. So what do negative rates have to do with the bond market? Well, negative rates means the returns on bonds, and we got two kinds of bonds, by the way. We got government bonds, sovereign bonds, sometimes called, and we have corporate bonds, private bonds. And government bonds usually take the form of 30-year bonds and then 10-year bonds, and you can go down to 5-year bonds, 2-year bonds. Below that, you have bonds of shorter duration. Those are called bills, treasury bills, right? The U.S. government bonds are called treasuries, treasury bonds, short-term treasury bills. In England, they're called gilts, government bonds, 30-year, 10-year. 10-year is kind of assumed to be the indicator of trend where bonds are going. In Germany, they call them Bunds, B-U-N-D-S, Bunds, right? And et cetera. And the government bond market, and all bonds, the yield, the interest rate, the yield, moves inversely to the price of bonds. So when the yield, the interest rate, drops low, the price of the bonds are rising. So if I bought bonds at, let's say, a 30-year bond at 3%, and the yield drops to virtually zero, that means that the price at which I bought that bond was relatively low, and it's double tripled. Well, when I sell those bonds again, I'm selling them at a price that's double triple of what I bought, and I realize a significant gain. It's just like buying stocks. You buy them low, and the price goes up of the stock, and you flip it, you sell it, and you make a big capital gain. Well, you could do that with bonds, too. Historically, traditionally, bonds did not move as volatilely as stocks, but they have been now for a number of years since the central banks, the U.S. Central Bank, the Federal Reserve, and other major central banks of the world, the Bank of Japan, European Central Bank, Bank of England, have been pumping all this money and liquidity into the global economy. Well, with all that money flowing into the global economy, investors are buying a lot of bonds. And in fact, the governments, the central banks themselves, have been buying back their own bonds from private investors. That's called QE, quantitative easing, which has been going on since 2009. So they've been buying back their own bonds and pumping money into the global economy, and the global economy with all that excess money, called liquidity, right, it's got to go somewhere. And it goes into buying stocks, it goes into buying derivatives, and it goes into buying bonds again. And so you've got this the situation of the government buying its own bonds. In other words, the demand for government bonds rises, and we know demand drives up the price of things, in this case the bonds, and private investors buying the bonds drives up the price of the bonds, drives down the yield or the interest rate. So you've got a bubble going on in bonds. I'm talking so far about sovereign or government bonds. We're not even talking yet about the corporate bond side. So a bubble is when the price rises faster and farther than the fundamentals justify. And that's what we got going on now in bonds, because the central banks, led by the Federal Reserve since 2009, have been pumping huge amounts of money into the economy and buying bonds themselves, buying back their own bonds, driving up the demand and the price for their own bonds. causing a bubble in bonds, which is emerging now. And that's a function of quantitative easing. It's also a function, more recently, of what's called negative interest rate policies. In other words, drive down the cost of bonds, not just to zero, but to negative. And that's what the governments in Japan and Europe, the Eurozone, the two major weak links in the global capitalist economy right now, have been doing. Japan started it because Japan started quantitative easing first. And Japan engaged in QE, major QE, the biggest QE of all the major advanced economies relative to the size of its own economy in 2013. Drove up stocks for a while, stock prices. Did not really have much of an effect on the real economy, which QE has not. It stimulates financial asset markets, like stocks, derivatives, other securities, including bonds. All right. When QE no longer worked, Japan decided here a little over a year ago to push interest rates into negative territory. Drive them down into negative territory, which drives the price up even more. Well, what does it mean to say rates are in negative territory? Well, what it means is that if you're a bank, right, and you borrow from the central bank, you have to pay the central bank. The central bank is not going to pay you an interest rate. You have to pay them to borrow and leave your money with the central bank. The whole idea of negative rates, theoretically, by the way, is that if banks have to pay to leave their money, their reserves, which they have to hold, with the central bank, that will discourage them from leaving that money sitting in the central bank and encourage them to lend it out into the real economy, lend it to businesses, and those businesses, the assumption is theoretically, will then invest in real asset investment, as it's called. In other words, plants and equipment and structures and so forth and inventories, all the things that require hiring people to make things. That's what real investment is, to make things. If you hire people, you're going to have to pay them wages and income. So more hiring, more jobs, more income, more consumption will stimulate GDP, stimulate the economy, increase demand for goods and services that will drive up prices of goods and services. That's the whole theoretical rationale for negative interest rates, which is, by the way, the same rationale was used for quantitative easing. How much has the major central banks pumped into the global economy since 2009 with the objective of raising prices, getting a little inflation going, which is always good for the economy. You see, no inflation or deflation is bad. We'll explain why, but some inflation is good, not too much, but some is good. But what we've had is no inflation or deflation in the major economy since 2009. That's bad, right? Because when you have a problem of no inflation or deflation, consumers hold up their consumption on big-ticket items. Why? Because they think the price is going to fall even more. So they wait for it to fall. Deflation's bad that way. Deflation discourages consumption. And same with businesses. If businesses think the prices of their goods that will come to market 6 months from now are going to be less than they are today, they won't invest. Uncertainty will prevent them from investing. So deflation is bad. That's why central banks want to pump up the price and the inflation rate if they can. But they haven't been able to, despite having pumped somewhere between $15 and $20 trillion just in QE between 2009 and 15 into the global economy. The U.S., if you just look at the balance sheets of the central banks, you'll tell you how much they've pumped in, actually a low level, because some of it's been paid off. But U.S., about $4 trillion. The Eurozone economy, if you look at the Eurozone Central Bank, European Central Bank, its balance sheet is about 78% of Eurozone GDP. So that's like three-fourths of about 13, 14 trillion. That's at least $3-4 trillion. Japan, even more. Let's say $4-5 trillion. Britain and the rest of the UE, several trillion more. You know, easily $15 trillion still on the balance sheets of just these four central banks of the advanced economy. So that'll tell you how much they pumped in with QE. And the whole idea was monetary policy was supposed to stimulate real investment. Well, as I said several times on the show, it hasn't done that. What's happened is the money has gone into financial markets around the world, speculation and so forth, right? Or it's been loaned into emerging markets for a while when they were growing. They're not anymore. Or it's being hoarded on bank balance sheets, private bank balance sheets. That's where the money has gone. It hasn't gone very much into expanding investment in real assets, plants, equipment, structures, so on and so forth. That's the problem. The monetary policy mechanism is broken. The theory does not work anymore. And that's because, as I've argued in my book, Systemic Fragility in a Global Economy, because of this new global financial structure that has emerged in the last several decades. Most of the investment is shifting. Most of this massive liquidity injection is shifting into financial speculation and financial investment. Well, okay, global stock markets have pumped up, but they're not going anywhere in the last year. So that avenue for all this excess liquidity has sort of declined. Global property markets, except for the high-end property and foreign capital flowing into these desirable areas, geographic areas like the west coast of the U.S. or places in Europe or in Australia and so forth, foreign money, wealthy people trying to invest in properties in stable economies, which only stimulates the high end of the market. The money isn't flowing there anymore. The money flows to some extent into foreign exchange currencies, up and down, and in derivatives and so forth. But it's not flowing into the stock markets anymore very much because of the global economy slowing, and everybody beginning to realize that. Just the rate of return, the profitability of investing in real things is not as great as investing in financial securities anymore. So the money is not flowing there. Where's all this money going to go? This $20 trillion of liquidity created by central banks in recent decades, it's out there, it's sloshing around, but it doesn't have stocks to go into anymore. Smart investors know that's all peaked and is about to go down. We'll talk about that. I think there's a major, major stock correction coming this summer, and we'll talk about that shortly, but where else is it going to go? It's going to go into bonds. Whether you talk about risky corporate bonds called high-yield bonds or less risky corporate bonds called investment-grade bonds or various kinds of government bonds. Right now, most of it's been flowing into government bonds, but it's beginning to flow as well into corporate bonds, and we're going to see a follow-on bubble in corporate bonds coming on the heels of this government bond bubble. And again, the bubble is indicated by zero and negative interest rates. When government bonds fall to zero or less negative, that means the prices of government bonds have escalated. So this is the play, you see. This is the play, the bond play, that's still going on, and I predict it's going to continue going on, creating a bond bubble. And that's what Bill Gross of Janus Capital was talking about, what he said, a supernova about to explode. Yes, there is a supernova. Well, I would say it's a nova at this point. It's not a supernova yet, but it's heading in that direction, right? Gross tract government bond yields back to the 16th century, right? He found that never have bond yields been as great, as low as they are, and bond prices consistently as high as they are, and they're going to be going higher, right? And that's because all this excess liquid capital out there, all the huge capital gains by wealthy investors that have been created, especially since 2009, has to have somewhere to go. And the government, the central banks, keep pumping even more into the global economy. So where does it go? Doesn't go into stocks. That play is over, right? The property play is over, except in these select high-end markets. So it's going into bonds everywhere. And we're creating a global bond bubble, right? And not only in government bonds, but now in Japan and in, just announced and started today, in fact, in Europe, the European Central Bank, are beginning to buy not only government bonds, increasing the demand and the price, but now they're buying corporate bonds, private bonds. Something very interesting has been going on in the last decade with central banks. Central banks, because of the failure of the capitalist banking system, which is broken, in other words, the central banks are entering the economies and playing the role that private banks used to play. It's very interesting. Trend going on here. We saw it first with QE, and now we're seeing it, of course, with negative interest rates and so forth. Right? Major changes where the state, the capitalist state, is becoming more and more integral to the whole functioning of the system. It has to get deeper into the system, the financial system in particular, to keep the system from crashing. So it's taking on a lot of these private roles that private banks used to take. We can see it, kind of a central bank creep going on here. By the way, my publisher has asked me to write a book about this, which will come out at the end of the year, called Central Banks on the Ropes, subtitle Monetary Policy and the Next Global Depression. As I've said here before, I think the U.S. economy is in trouble, is slowing. We would have a recession here this year, but it's an election year, and the government will pick up the slack in the economy before the November election to make sure that there isn't a disruption before that. It always does that in election years, by the way. The government holds back its spending and then pumps it in starting in the summer before the election, so it looks like in September, October, everything's going great. But that will quickly reverse here in the U.S. Right after the election, and I'm almost certain, I would say 70-80%, there'll be a recession no later in 2017. It could even get out of hand and occur before, but I don't think so. Of course, Europe is barely growing, has been for at least 6-7 years, barely meaning less, on average, less than 5, one-half of 1%, 0.5 of 1% GDP growth. And, of course, Japan is in and out of recession, and again now 5 times since 2009. So these are the two weak links, the basket cases of the global capitalist economy, Japan and the Eurozone, EU. And together they constitute about $20 trillion of global GDP, bigger than the U.S. economy itself, twice as big as the Chinese economy when you put Japan and Europe together. So it's very, very important that in these two sectors of the global capitalist economy, Europe and Japan, that there's essentially no growth, hasn't been for some time, and actually is probably less than no growth. And we have these massive QE programs followed now by these massive negative interest rate programs, NERP, as they call it, N-I-R-P, NERPs, negative interest rate programs. Very significant what's going on. And Gross is finally caught on to this, being someone who really knows the global bond markets, right? He's raising a warning about this, as he and others did about the subprime market crash back in 2006 and 2007, right? He was forewarning of that, a few others as well. And now they're forewarning the global economies in increasing trouble here. Interest rates are approaching zero and less, right? So what are the consequences of these negative rates, we might say? Right? Apart from just creating a bubble, a financial bubble in bonds, right? Which is about to spread from government to private corporate bonds here. What are some of the consequences of this? Not the false theoretical explanation that it will force banks to lend and we'll get real investment and job growth and real GDP and consumption. That's not that's the textbook that's not working, like so much other than the textbooks not working. What are some of the consequences of this negative interest rate, this coming supernova? Right? Well, one thing it's doing, the negative rates in Europe and in Japan are causing investors to shift their money out of these economies and the banks and so forth, shift the money out of Europe, out of Japan, and sending it to the U.S., to invest in U.S. treasuries. In other words, the negative rates in Japan and Europe are having a contagion effect on government bond rates here in the U.S. All this money capital flows. I mean, why leave your money and have to pay the central bank money, right? Send the money to somewhere in the globe that you can still get positive interest rates. And, of course, in the U.S., interest rates still are positive, although they are falling as well. 30-year bond rates are about 2.5% yield interest paid. And 10-year is about, 1.7, something like that. So you can still get a return on your money if you move it out of Europe and Japan into the U.S. But the problem is with all that money flow to the U.S. treasuries, that's increasing the demand for U.S. treasuries, driving the price of U.S. bonds, government bonds, up, and the yield, the rate, down. In other words, it's having a knock-on effect on U.S. government bonds, similar. Right. This is a problem of the global economy that's been created in the image of the financial system and financial speculators. You know, in the 1980s, what happened was the U.S., led by the U.S., controls on global money flows were ended. Right? Capital controls, they call them. Money flows were all ended. So money could flow easily across borders without any restrictions. Starting the previous decade, the 1970s is when the central bank started pumping all this money into the economy. They could do so because now there was no what was called Bretton Woods International Monetary Standard, and central banks were released to pump as much as they wanted for various reasons. Into the global economy. Okay, all this money started flowing into the global economy from the central banks, all this liquidity, and then it started moving cross national borders by eliminating capital controls. And then we got the technological change in the 1990s, which created the internet, which allowed these flows to occur instantaneously across borders. And it's almost impossible to control these flows with no controls and technology today. And then, of course, deregulation is really about allowing the global capital flows and releasing all of this money capital to go wherever financial speculators want it to go. Those are the big changes since the 1970s that have occurred that have given us this major financialization of the global economy that exists today. And the financialization is wreaking havoc on real investment, diverting money capital created that otherwise would have gone into creating structures and real investment and equipment and so forth, diverting it into financial markets, of which we have now proliferating liquid markets around the world, and institutions created called shadow banks to move this money around. Right? Now, shadow banks are not really just an entity in and of themselves, although in some extent they are. You know, shadow banks are hedge funds, private equity firms, and insurance companies, pension funds, etc. We call these the capital markets. And the growth of these shadow banks are a phenomenon in the last several decades as well. But the shadow banking has penetrated the commercial banks. A good part of the commercial banks are shadow banking functions, and even large non-bank multinational corporations have become, quote, embedded shadow banks. In other words, part of their operations are really banking operations. And shadow banks are deregulated. They're not subject to regulation very much. And now we even have online shadow banking that has occurred in a number of places, particularly mortgages and credit and so forth, right? We see this happening. Lending Club and so forth, kind of online peer-to-peer lending, et cetera. So this whole changing financial structure has risen up in recent decades. In the wake of this massive money flowing and unlimited controls and technology and so forth, the money has to go somewhere. So you've got to create institutions to move the money around into these new liquid markets that exist everywhere. And those are primarily the shadow banks, you see. And then you create all these financial securities in which all this excess liquidity and money can be invested in. And then, you know, you got all this speculation and all these esoteric things, derivatives and so forth, growing. And this is what I call financialization. It's an institutional structure of shadow banks of various kinds, embedded, online, hybrid, traditional, the capital markets expansion, money capital created by central banks on limited amounts, right? And massive global money flows instantaneously, different kinds of financial securities to sop up all of this excess liquidity and capital, and this shift to financial asset investing, a speculative shift, which has a concurrent decline in real investing, real asset investing. And that's why now they are, after a decade or so, they're saying, gee, there's no productivity growth. Well, that's because there's no real investment in real things going on the way it used to. So productivity is declining. And when productivity declines, what do? Well, non-bank companies try to cut costs. How do they do that? They get rid of full-time jobs, they get rid of benefits, and they cut their labor costs, their wage costs. And when wage income does not grow, you don't have demand for real goods, and therefore it justifies less investment in real things. You see, it becomes a vicious downward cycle. But it's all because of this financialization, as I've just described it. Not as many who talk about financialization in a simplistic way of, the profits of banks. Right. Well, how do you measure the profits of banks when a lot of, quote, the banking function is now in non-bank companies, multinational companies? You know, how do you even know what bank profits are? You can't separate it out. By the way, let me digress. I have a running debate with some of my Marxist economic friends about this falling rate of profit thesis or hypothesis. You know, they insist that crises have to do with profit rates declining in non-bank companies. Right? That's where it really begins. That's where the problem really begins. Well, that assumes that it's profits that finance real investment. But if you look at the data, maybe only 20% of investment, real investment to the extent that it occurs, is being financed, paid for, from internal funds, from profits. Only 20%. Well, the other 80% is equity financing, bond financing, government subsidies, and so on and so forth. So you can't really talk about falling rates. By the way, a rate of profit, it's not falling profits, it's the rate of profit that they say is important. Well, maybe we'll have a show at some point why I think the falling rate of profit is not the right way for Marxist economists to be looking at the crisis in the global capitalist system. You know, it's investment that's important, and it's this shift from real investment to financial investment that is behind the crisis in the global capitalist system today. And if anyone wants to read more about that, again, my book, Systemic Fragility and Global Economy, has several chapters on this financialization theme, this institutional shadow banks, financial asset markets, and the financial investing shift, and so forth. Go to my blog, jackrasmus.com, and you can then go to the publisher, click on the book icon, and you can read some of this. I'll be posting, I have posted on my website several articles summarizing some of this that I've published recently. Again, you can go to my blog, jackrasmus.com, and from there you can go right to my my website, kyklosproductions.com, kyklosproductions.com, and you can read some of these articles by myself and others summarizing the major themes of this book. But how is this all tied into the bond bubble? Well, it's really what I've been saying all along in the book, that we have the shift to financial assets going on. The money is not flowing into real investment, creating real jobs, real income, and therefore real demand that would then further stimulate real investment is flowing out into these financial asset markets. And, of course, right after the 2009 a crisis here, a lot of it went to stocks. That's why the global stock market doubled from $32 to $64 trillion, although that's leveled off now. A lot of it went into China and emerging markets for a while, causing bubbles there, as well as some real investment down there. But now that money is flowing back to the U.S. and advanced economies and creating even more excess liquidity with no place to go. Except into bonds, you see, causing the bond bubble here. The bond bubble is the culmination of this financial speculation, and it could be the very last phase of this latest stage of financial speculation since 2009. Could be the last stage, because when the bond bubble busts, you ain't seen nothing yet compared to stock markets or subprime housing markets. That's small fry compared to a bond market bust. And all bubbles do end in bust. There's just no way out. And we definitely have a government sovereign debt bond bubble at work, and I predict it will soon spill over into a corporate bond bubble as well, especially if we see this summer stock markets begin to correct here, as I believe they will. The money that $32 trillion in stock markets is going to look for a safe haven. It's going to go for government bonds. You know, if the stock markets retreat significantly in Europe and Japan, it will just accelerate the movement into U.S. Treasuries, already caused by the negative interest rate programs in those countries. Brexit, the U.K. Exit. From the European Union, which comes up June 23rd, the vote. I will be having a show next week on that and publishing an article on that for Telesur before the 23rd. That will accelerate the stock retreat, I believe, and therefore when the money comes out of the stock market, it will go into the bond market, particularly government bond markets, and drive rates even lower. China. We have still continuing capital flight out of China going on. And right now, China is reaching the upper limits of its currency band, which means that on the horizon is the fact that China's going to have to devalue or stretch out that ban, which is the devaluation of its currency. And when that happens, you'll have even more money flowing out of China. Where's it going to go? Well, with the rest of the global economy and global trade slowing, it's certainly not going to go into investing into real assets. It's going to go into financial markets and safe ones, first and foremost, which mean government bonds, especially U.S. government bonds. And we could have, as it becomes more and more obvious that the U.S. economy is slowing, the stock market in the U.S., which is, you know, continuing bouncing up and down between 17 and 18,000 on the Dow, and similarly on S&P 500 and NASDAQ, that money is going to come out of stocks and go into bonds, government bonds. So we could see a significant acceleration of the government bond bubble here in the U.S. as well as in Japan and the Eurozone and England. Rates will go even more negative, and prices will go up even further. Well, what happens when when it goes negative? As I said earlier, banks have to pay the central bank for leaving their reserves with the central bank. So, in other words, they lose money. And some banks are even beginning to, private banks beginning to say, why leave it with the central bank and have to pay the central bank? Let's just leave it in our bank vaults, right? In other words, let's stuff it under the bank mattress, you might say, right? It's better not paying anything, even if you're not earning anything on the money, than it is to pay the central bank, just to leave the money with the central bank. The whole idea of once again, the negative interest rate was to force banks to lend, but the banks won't lend. Why won't they lend? Several reasons why they won't lend, and that is it's lend meaning to real business and so forth. One reason is with the economies performing so poorly, non-bank businesses aren't interested in even borrowing. You know, why borrow money and expand your business when people don't have enough money to even buy your goods now, right? There's no sense in expanding. You see, that's what's wrong. All this monetary policy everywhere, this what I call this money supply fetish that central banks have and governments have in the advanced economies, and that is if they only pump more supply of money into the economy, you know, and make interest rates go lower and lower, the cost of borrowing will be so low that banks will borrow, private banks will borrow the money from the central banks and loan it out to non-bank businesses because it costs so little. Well, the supply of money and the cost of money is only part of the picture of investment. You know, there's the demand for money that's important. In other words, you can pump all the supply of money you want into the economy, but if the economy is slowing and things aren't doing so well, who's going to want to borrow it? Supply is only half of the picture. But, you know, that's what the mainstream economists really still believe, that money supply is the key. By the way, I've written an article that I will post in the next couple of weeks, maybe, for the European Financial Review, why economists keep getting it wrong, why they don't understand financial instability. I won't get into those arguments. Maybe we'll talk about that at another show here. Why mainstream economics is intellectually defunct. It just can't explain these things anymore because its models are built upon the 1960s and 1970s and before economy, before all this new financial structure upended everything, before 21st century global capitalism became a reality. You see, their models and their theories are still based on mid-20th century capitalism, and they won't update them or change them. They just don't understand what's going on. They don't understand finance because they've never been trained in finance. Well, I won't get too much further into that argument. We'll attack that topic another time. But, you know, negative interest rates, low, zero interest rates before, now negative. Banks will just hoard the cash. You know, they'll just put it on their own vaults and their own balance sheets, and they're beginning to do just that, right? Or maybe they'll lend a little bit offshore here and there where it looks like it may be justified. But most of it will go into financial speculation or hoarded on their bank balance sheets, right? And that's because they won't lend. That's another reason why central banks are going directly into the economy themselves, pumping money into the economy, because the private banks aren't doing it. It shows that there's a breakdown in the global capitalist banking system. It's just not working the way it used to work. You've got not only $10 trillion in negative interest rate government bonds out there, you have over $10 trillion in non-performing non-bank corporate loans. And non-performing meaning there's $10 trillion of non-bank loans that have been borrowed from private banks in which the companies can't pay or aren't paying principal and interest on. They're non-performing. They're about to default. In fact, they should default, but banks are worried about defaulting too much because it will send a message of even bigger problems and cause even a bigger panic. So, you know, they're not calling in the loans here. They're trying to live with them. Well, it's the same thing they did with the housing market. You know, there was a lot of non-performing mortgage loans that they just didn't call in, didn't foreclose on for several years because they were afraid that that would just precipitate even more crisis. Well, the same thing's going on with bank loans right now. Well, this negative interest rate not only does not work through the private banking system and shows that central banks are morphing into a kind of a quasi-private banking institution as well. QE is no longer sufficient to stimulate even the financial markets. That's why NERP is going on. By the way, after this, what comes after NERP? After negative interest rates, after it becomes clear that negative interest rates not only are not stimulating the economy, but they are causing even greater disruption of the global economy. Well, what are some of these greater disruptions that are already beginning to appear? One, negative and zero rates now for 8 years means households and saving, household savers, are losing all kind of money. Yeah. You know, if I'm not making anything on my CDs or my other investments that I live off to as a retiree, I'm losing money. I'm going backwards. I'm going to reduce my consumption. I don't have enough to live on. That's why a lot of seniors are going back to work. Right? There's no returns on their nest egg. And Social Security is so minimal, right? And the pensions and IRAs, they blew up. A lot of the IRAs blew up with the subprime. There's no savings. There's no income. Pension funds in deep doo-doo. Insurance annuities in deep doo-doo. Insurance companies, right? Because the rates are so low. And even banks themselves, with rates so low, the spread, what they borrow from the central bank and what they lend is so low, there's a question of their profitability going forward. I'm talking about the commercial banks, you know, that rely on the saver spreads, not the shadow banks that engage in speculation and derivatives and so forth, right? But anyway, the consequences of zero or negative interest rates are household consumption declines, pension funds, enter a difficulty phase here in which they are. They can't earn enough to maintain their pension payouts. Insurance companies and annuities, the same thing on the private side, right? So we get consumption stagnation for a significant part of the consuming household public here, maybe a third of it, you know, stagnation or negative going on. By the way, that's why the central bank, the U.S. Federal Reserve, is desperate to raise interest rates a little bit so the pension funds, insurance companies, and household savers, retirees get a little relief after 8 years, you say, which they haven't. But they're having a heck of a time trying to raise interest rates when the economy is in such a flat to declining stagnant situation, which it is. So the reality of negative interest rates is it causes more problems than it resolves. It doesn't really have the effect of stimulating real investment, but it does have the effect of compressing real consumption, you see. QE had the same thing. QE, quantitative easing, where the central banks go in and buy up private investors' bonds, pumped money into the economy, but it went offshore, it went into financial speculation, and so forth. It didn't go into real investment. The same thing with NERP. Negative rates is not producing real investment, and it's causing even greater problems. What comes next? Well, they're already talking about helicopter money, right? Helicopter money is another phrase that represents, if incomes are not growing for the majority of the population, where are you going to get consumption to get the economy going again? Well, that's where helicopter money idea comes in. It's just an idea, but it's being debated among realistic, policy sectors here among the capitalist class. They got their position papers and they're looking at it. Well, that's where they're just going to have to give so much money per month to households. Actually write a check, you see, and because there's not enough income growth to stimulate real investment and real growth anymore. A helicopter drop. The idea is to drop money from a helicopter. That's the metaphor, you see. And central bankers and others have said, it may come to that. We may have to do that if we can't get real consumption going. Well, you can't get real consumption going because all the money you pumped in previously has not gone into real investment to create real jobs and real wage income growth in order to stimulate consumption, you see? That's the problem, the ultimate problem. That's also why productivity is not growing and it's declining now in the U.S., as well as in the other global economies. So all this monetary policy recovery has fed these problems, and it's fed the financial side of the global economy without stimulating the real side of the economy. And, of course, then you get these crummy jobs, low-paid jobs, contingent jobs, as businesses attempt to deal with the low growth and low demand by cutting their costs, and especially their wage costs, you see. That comes in the wake of this as well. Big problem going on. And it's causing other problems. The negative rates are causing problems. We're going to see, the stock market correction is going to feed into this thing. Money market mutual funds are going to shut down, causing even more credit and financial stress here. And the whole problem is the private banking system is not working the way it used to work. And that's because we have this new financial structure overlaid on the whole system that sucks increasing amounts of money capital into these financial markets and financial speculation instead of into real investment as it used to. You see, central banks have lost control even of the money supply. Pumping all this money is supposed to generate real investment, but it's not. It's siphoning out into these financial markets. And as the markets reach bubble level, can't go any higher, like global stocks aren't going any higher. They just bounce up against the ceiling, right? And property is not going any higher except in very specific markets, niche markets. Where's all this money that's been pumped in for so long and continuing going into the global economy going to go? It's going into bonds. And we're creating another bubble. You see, from my book is that not only is this financial asset shift, but we have what I call this global money parade with this massive amount of liquidity out there sloshing around the global economy, far more liquidity and money than there are real investment opportunities. And besides, real asset investment is not as profitable as financial speculation and investment. So they create more and more of these liquid financial markets. It becomes a global casino where the 200,000 finance capital elite around the world, you know, 200,000, who are these people? These are people who make $25 million a year in income growth, not their asset wealth, but their income. Their assets are so massive they generate $5 to $25 million spinoff of income from those assets every year, capital gains of various kinds. This is the global finance capital elite, and they're so wealthy and powerful, they've penetrated and dominate now, at least in the advanced economies, the political system itself. I mean, who put Obama in office? It was his New York hedge fund buddies that he met at Harvard. Right? And, of course, the Pritzkers and billionaires in Chicago who pulled him out of the South Chicago slums and said, okay, run for office here. You're an articulate young black man. Run for office. We'll pull all the strings and give you all the money. And, you run for Illinois State Assembly one time, and from there we move you immediately to state senator, and from there you don't even finish, we move you to president, right? This is the trajectory of Barack Obama. And of course we know Hillary, her trajectory, since she left the State Department, tens of trillions of dollars in fees, speaking fees, right? When Bill Clinton left office, his net worth was less than $1 million. Today, the Clintons are worth, at least $200 million. Well, where the hell did they get all this money? It wasn't from book sales. No. No way. And the rich, the super rich, the financial rich, they buy these politicians, and then they get the Supreme Court to open up, the money spigot even further, and the rest of the story everybody knows, right? And we'll get to vote for two billionaires, one multimillionaire, hundreds of million multimillionaire representing the billionaires, and the other billionaire representing the billionaires. And then everyone thinks that Bernie Sanders was going to do something different, right? Well, I've deja vu. Bernie is deja vu, right? You saw what happened to Dennis Kucinich, right? You saw what happened to Jesse Jackson when he tried to run as an independent. Even Howard Dean, So if they don't want you, they will put their thumb on you and you're gone. Well, they let Bernie play in the left wing of the Democratic sandbox here. There was no chance from the beginning for Bernie, and they knew it. And if the superdelegates didn't do the trick of preventing him, well, then they would have changed the rules of credentials committee as conventions. When you manipulate conventions, I've been a lot of union conventions, and the key is who controls the credentials committee, who controls the rules committee. Whoever does that controls the convention. They would have pulled some strings there to prevent him from playing in the Democratic Party. You cannot reform either wing of the single corporate party of America. It's unreformable. You cannot do it from the inside. How many times do we have to go through this to realize that they control all the cards in the dealership? They'll deal you whatever card they want to deal you. And you cannot reform it from the inside. You have to have an independent third-party movement in this country. And it's not going to come from within the Democratic Party. I admired and supported a lot of the positions of Bernie Sanders, but not Bernie Sanders himself until he declared an independent, which he hasn't done, and he will not do. Okay, next week, we will talk about Brexit. Listen in, Jack Rasmus, Alternative Visions.